Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight we have a lecture featured in a recent one-day conference sponsored by the Institute for the Study of Conflict Ideology and Policy. The conference was entitled Sick Transit, Power Transfer Moscow Style. Our lecture tonight, entitled Stalin's Heirs, is presented by University Professor and Institute Director Yuri Ronin. We begin with opening remarks by Boston University President ad interim Dr. Aram Chobanian. Dr. Chobanian.
Welcome to this great symposium. We're all going to learn a considerable amount about transitions of power in different situations in Russia. And I'm really very, very pleased to welcome you to this symposium sponsored by the Institute for the Study of Conflict, Ideology, and Policy. The Soviet Union was born as the child of two conflicts, the long-term conflicts that ranged throughout Russia, and the more recent conflicts of the First World War. It was amply supplied with ideology, but because of the flaws of its ideology, it failed to develop successful policies, and so it dissolved before our eyes. The Soviet regime had immense power over its people, but with little legitimacy, it eventually lost its authority. Professor Ronan and his colleagues are experts in exploring and understanding these complex issues. The Soviet Union and its successor states have yet to develop the means to exchange authority between parties over governments that we in America take for granted in even our towns, our cities, counties, states, and the whole country. Hopefully, the Russians are moving slowly in our direction. But the path for the transfer of power from Lenin to Stalin to Khrushchev and to his successors to Gorbachev and Putin has been by coups or covert manipulations. It certainly is not the path we have followed in this country. This conference will examine the flaws in the Russian system from the Tsarist period to Russia, to the Russian Federation. We look forward to hearing from an outstanding group of speakers who will enlighten us on these issues. Thank you very much.
As a people, we tend to focus like a laser on the urgent issue of the day. But we do so strictly one problem at a time. Washington, notoriously, is a single-issue town. So yesterday's concern isn't only forgotten. It becomes an irritant. It distracts from concentration on what is perceived to be the most urgent question of the day. And this holds true particularly for the topic on which we have focused for the better part of five decades, to wit, the Soviet Union and specifically Russian affairs. For a very long time, translation from Russian sources, analysis thereof, were the cottage industry of Washington. Then the Soviet Union imploded, the problem of terrorism surfaced, and suddenly, government, the media, and yes, academia sloughed off the investment of half a century as irrelevant. And America's institutional memory was switched off, as it were. The result can be seen with the naked eye in terms of the diminished intake of students who wish to learn the Russian language, absorb Russian literature, and above all, to analyze and understand the internal developments in the debris of empire that constitutes the post-Soviet arena. There seems to be little understanding of the impact of Russian domestic factors on international relations. The mission of the Institute at I have the honor to direct, has been to attempt to divert this current and in our own modest way to prepare cadres that would be available once decision makers awoke to the fact that yesterday's concerns remain highly relevant for today and for tomorrow. The late unlamented Yosif Vissarionovich occasionally coined memorable phrases, and one of them was, cadres are everything. What he meant was, it is personnel that determines policy. My colleagues at this conference and I decided that we should address the problem by examining the effects of the fundamental flaw that besets the Russian polity, pre-Soviet, Soviet, and, alas, post-Soviet. As President Chobanian has indicated, that particular ailment is caused by the absence of a transparent, consistently implemented, non-arbitrary transfer of power mechanism, without which there can be no legitimacy. So we decided to analyze the impact of this flaw on four succession crises. In 1953, once Stalin lapsed into a coma, during the coups of 1957 and 64 in the Khrushchev era, the coups of 1991 that resulted in the implosion of the Soviet Union, and finally the ascent to power of Vladimir Putin in 1999. It's my task to address the question how Stalin's heirs, to cite the title of Yevtushenko's famous poem, attempted to apportion power from March the 2nd on, once Stalin was found in a coma that was diagnosed very soon as irreversible. Now, this endeavor is not rendered any easier by the fact that the successor of the late KGB, now called FSB, President Putin's alma mater, controls access to the archives. In theory, there is a 30-year rule for the release of all documents, excepting the very few that still have any current intelligence implication. In fact, it is 51 years since the period with which I'm dealing, and none of the actors of the 1953 succession struggle have been alive now for the better part of two decades, yet most of the proceedings of the top Communist Party apparatus, the Politburo as it was once called, remain classified. What is even more droll, for a very brief moment, a small window had opened, and one or two researchers were able to see certain of these documents and to take notes. The result was that a minuscule portion of the classified material was actually published. However, this didn't stop the FSB from reclassifying even the published parts. In any case, as a result of this perverse approach, to call it a policy would be a compliment, most of the proceedings of the Politburo, that was then called the Presidium of the Communist Party, remain inaccessible. Luckily, protocols of the plenary sessions of a larger and consequently less secretive body, the Central Committee of the Party, are accessible now for the most part. There, of course, one has to differentiate between stenograms and later carefully edited versions. The former contain occasionally significant material, whereas the latter omit any potentially embarrassing and therefore revealing passages. course, it's particularly useful to have both versions so that one can see precisely what was ordered to be eliminated. Despite the passage of time, the plenary sessions have kept returning to the events of 1953 almost compulsively, the reason being that they constitute a convenient vehicle for compromising, meaning defaming, whichever of Stalin's heirs was being ousted by his rivals. However, plenary sessions in general tended to become much more revealing during the 1950s. As I said, they were convened to denounce leaders who had been demoted or purged. But while in July of 1953, the accused, Beria, was imprisoned and unable to defend himself, by June of 1957, the accused were not only present, but unafraid to denounce the charges against them as lies. The result is that these sessions became more difficult to stage and less predictable. Additionally, in the last two decades, as Soviet power waned, more explicit memoirs started to appear of participants in or witnesses to the struggles of March, April 1953. Other very revealing material became accessible, such as the sign-in, sign-out sheets of persons attending sessions in Stalin's Kremlin cabinet and Stalin's special file of material sent to him by the security services. As a result, reconstruction has become possible of the kto kavo, the who did what to whom, of that very brief period. Of course, as in a detective story, it is necessary always to analyze motive, opportunity, and means, because understandably, no protocol will document who did what and when. After all, it isn't very becoming for contestants in a power struggle to reveal their manipulations in the presence of an official taking notes. So, inevitably, my contribution had to entail minute examination of material of a frequently esoteric nature, and the presentation of that would take many hours and possibly bore you to death. So I will try to extract vignettes that shed light on significant discoveries. In his last years, Stalin systematically removed from the scene of power his oldest and most prestigious comrades in arms, particularly Molotov, who had been premier, or to be precise, chairman of the Council of Ministers for many years, as well as foreign minister, and was considered generally to be Stalin's number two. Others that were treated in this way included Voroshilov, one-time Minister of Defense, who had fought at Stalin's side during the Civil War in what became known subsequently as Stalingrad. Kaganovich, who was intermittently boss of the Ukraine, and Mikoyan, who had been Stalin's partner in the Transcaucasus. In their place, Stalin increasingly associated politically and socially with a quartet that consisted of younger, actually middle-aged figures, and they included Malenkov, a key operator in the secretariat of the Communist Party, who had also extended his tentacles into the security apparatus, Beria, who had once headed these services, had been sidetracked to become head of the ultra-secret commission to develop Soviet nuclear weapons, and he appeared to be in some peril because of a trumped-up charge concerning affairs in his native Mingrelia, and that fingered him obliquely as a co-conspirator. Khrushchev, who also had been head of the Ukraine intermittently and had been brought to Moscow to become head of the Capital's party apparatus, and was increasingly competing with Malenkov. And finally, Bulganin, who had been defense minister in the post-war period, and whom his military subordinates viewed with disdain as a bemedaled civilian. The diagram illustrates the Soviet power structure that consisted of three parts, like Caesar's Gaul, the Politburo and Secretariat of the Communist Party's Central Committee, and the Council of Ministers representing the Soviet state. There were scores of ministers, therefore the Council needed an executive organ called the Presidium, with about a dozen ministers, and a smaller, more powerful body that consisted of seven at one time. But in the fall of 1952, Stalin duplicated the terminology of the Soviet state apparatus and brought it into the Communist Party, replacing the Politburo with a large party presidium and a smaller bureau of the presidium, so that now both the Council of Ministers and the Party Central Committee were governed by two organs with the identical name. This was simplified by Stalin's heirs, who merged the two bodies, both in the Council of Ministers and in the Party Central Committee, calling each presidium, but with a small membership resembling the former bureau of the presidium. Renan's law, the importance of a political body is in inverse proportion to the number of its members. 5 months before his death, Stalin hurled a grenade into the political arena. Following an increasingly rare party congress held in October of 1952, he announced the creation of a bloated party presidium, more than twice the size of the previous Politburo, saturated with persons that were barely known to party members or to the public. The general suspicion in the Soviet Union and in the West was that Stalin intended to replace at least his four oldest colleagues with these obscure figures, who constituted the majority of the new presidium. Perhaps no less important than their age, at least in Stalin's increasingly anti-Semitic mindset, was the fact that two of the veterans had Jewish wives and one was Jewish himself. Stalin's attacks against them constituted the prelude to the overtly anti-Semitic paranoid delirium which has become known as the doctor's plot. We have access now to material that sheds light on this prelude in the form of the protocol of the plenum of the Party's Central Committee of October 16, 1952, plus the memoirs of participants at this event that permit us to reconstruct what actually happened. Stalin delivered a fierce denunciation of Molotov and Mikoyan, accompanied by somewhat less poisonous arrows aimed at Voroshilov and Kaganovich. This seemed to signal the end of the careers of the first two, if not of their very lives. But as we now know from the memoirs of participants, he ordered that no minutes be taken of this speech, which consequently is not mentioned in the protocol. What does appear is highly significant. It lists the membership of the new bloated party presidium, but goes on to deprive that body of any significance by announcing simultaneously the creation of an inner top-secret body called the Bureau of the Presidio, in which neither Molotov nor Mikoyan were included. Indeed, the protocol shows that even Voroshilov had his name penciled in as an afterthought. Even more significant is the fact that the memoirs of participants cite Stalin as stating that the new Bureau of the Presidio must be kept secret, and I quote, in order to deceive the enemies of the party, unquote. I wonder whether he meant Western Sovietologists, who were kept busy for months trying to decipher whose acolytes these members of the bloated party presidium were, a body that in fact hardly ever met. For months, Sovietologists remained unaware of the existence of the inner body, the Bureau of the Presidium, since Stalin kept displaying to the public the veterans who'd been excluded. For instance, several weeks after the October plenum, Molotov and Mikoyan appeared with Stalin and other leaders taking the traditional salute at the Bolshevik Revolution anniversary parade. In any case, this charade had significant impact on the succession struggle, since the public and most of the party had no idea that Stalin had cast Molotov and Mikoyan into the outer darkness if his successors were to retain the membership of the secret Bureau of the Presidium. It would appear as if they had ousted Stalin's oldest and best-known comrades. That would have presented a major problem, since any new leadership had to ensure the appearance of legitimacy. And that meant seamless continuity. Indeed, Stalin's heirs were painfully aware of this need. Their first public proclamation after his death stated, and I quote, "The most important task is to ensure uninterrupted and correct leadership." So they had very little choice but to reinstate Molotov and Mikoyan. That posed problems of its own, however. The cerebral hemorrhage that had put Stalin into a coma was not pronounced as irreversible until March the 3rd. Consequently, for some time, his lieutenants could not be certain that he would not recover. And this explains some bizarre phenomena. The doctors were not summoned to his dacha for many hours to examine the unconscious Stalin. They had barely concluded their initial diagnosis when his lieutenants were off to a 20-minute session in his Kremlin office. They had hardly any time in which to discuss the situation, not to speak of reaching decisions. But the meeting itself constituted a decision of sorts. And we have two documents that reflect this fact. One consists of the sign-in sheet that listed all the participants in the Kremlin session. The other is the protocol of that meeting. They are far from identical. The sign-in sheet lists all of the leaders, including Molotov and Mikoyan, in alphabetical order, followed at the end by less prestigious personalities, including two medical officers. This constituted, in effect, the rehabilitation of these two outcasts and their re-inclusion in the post-Stalin regime. The protocol, however, identifies Malenkov as chairing the meeting, followed by the seven other members of the narrow Bureau of the Presidium in alphabetical order, whereas Molotov and Mikoyan are listed as present only by virtue of their membership in the bloated Presidium. Even so, the fact is that they were picked from among 16 other members of that Presidium to be included in this select leadership session. And the question arises, why their membership at the meeting is portrayed so differently in the two documents? The resolution of the problem is surprisingly simple. The protocol was an official party document, likely to be seen by members of the secretariat and possibly members of the Central Committee. The more arbitrary a regime is, the more likely its leaders are to be sticklers for formality, in search of a bureaucratic pseudo-legitimacy. the protocol could not arbitrarily alter the membership of the institutions that were created at the October 16 plenum. It would have demanded a meeting of similar size and standing. It was acceptable, therefore, to single out Molotov and Mikoyan from among the members of the bloated presidium, but not yet to include them formally in the inner bureau of the presidium. The sign-in sheet, on the other hand, had no official standing. Indeed, it was most unlikely to be seen by anyone other than the participants in the Kremlin session. Therefore, it could reflect the new lineup in its totality, while the protocol could only constitute a halfway house. Moreover, the protocol had to be worded carefully because of the possibility, remote though it was, that Stalin might regain consciousness. His lieutenants feared this contingency almost superstitiously. For example, the March 2 protocol states that members of the Presidium Bureau were to be in attendance on the unconscious Stalin at all times. Indeed, we know from the memoirs that three watches were organized, consisting respectively of Malenkov and Beria, Khrushchev and Bulganin, and Voroshilov and Kaganovich. Non-members of the Presidium Bureau, such as Mikoyan, were sent specifically to implement tasks elsewhere just to keep them away from the dacha. Clearly, the others feared that a miraculously revived Stalin might catch sight of persons he had ousted and would punish all of them. On March 6, when the new leadership was finally broadcast, it became apparent that Stalin's lieutenants were right to create the appearance of legitimacy by re-including Molotov and Mikoyan. Even though Molotov was given a prominent role, many voiced amazement, some in letters to leading personalities, that Malenkov, rather than Molotov, had been made chairman of the Council of Ministers. Even the diplomatic community shared in this surprise, the British Embassy. One may imagine what would have been the reaction if Molotov had been ousted altogether. Once Stalin's illness was pronounced as irreversible on March the 3rd, his heirs became more daring. Even so, they resorted to an unprecedented meeting of very dubious standing as far as the party's statutes were concerned, to announce a very partial apportionment of powers among the contestants. This gathering brought together several hundred persons representing the party's central committee, the whole Council of Ministers, and the puppet presidium of the Supreme Soviet. This occasion produced other data that requires some head-scratching on the part of Sovietologists. Thus, the order of precedence was read out. And it read Malenkov, Beria, Molotov, Voroshilov, Khrushchev, Bulganin, etc. Now, for many years, we had taken it for granted that precedence, in print or in pictures, reflects the order of importance of the personalities concerned. Clearly, this was not the case with the list that was read out on March the 5th. In no way could Khrushchev be considered less important than Molotov, not to mention the grizzled Voroshilov, who was given a purely decorative post as the figurehead Soviet president. Indeed, the meeting itself illustrated the fact that Khrushchev, if anything, was the third most important leader. In a clause that was not published at the time, Malenkov, Beria, and Khrushchev were empowered, and I quote, to put Stalin's files in proper order. Now, this apparently clerical task was actually of supreme importance because these files contained potentially lethal, compromising material against each and every political figure. Being entrusted with this duty meant access to papers that could arm the Malenkov, Beria, Khrushchev troika with deadly political ammunition. It so happens that none of the three trusted one another, and they decided consequently to burn the files. In many ways, the arrangements of March 5 constituted a considerable departure from dispositions that Stalin had made. It may be counterintuitive, but Stalin had actually prepared for the exigency of his absence from power. I have now seen the relevant documents. Typically, of course, he did not anoint one successor. That would have been far too dangerous. Instead, he rearranged the power structure in a manner that excluded the veterans, but involved at least 8 other individuals. For this purpose, he diluted the Council of Ministers by transferring such important members as Malenkov, Bulganin, and Khrushchev to other tasks. It's worth noting also that he ceased attending meetings of the Council of Ministers and confined himself almost entirely to sessions of the Communist Party's presidium. Moreover, he reinforced the standing committees on foreign affairs and defense of the party, placing Malenkov at the head of the former and Bulganin at the head of the latter. He created a troika of Beria, Malenkov, and Bulganin to supervise the special organs and their operations, which is the usual code for the less printable activities of the security organs. Members of a second troika, consisting of Malenkov, Khrushchev, and Bulganin, were selected in case of Stalin's absence to chair and run the party's presidium. Yet another troika, Malenkov, Pyegov, and Suslov, were similarly appointed to run the party's secretariat. And finally, Beria, Peruchin, and Saburov were to substitute for Stalin at the Council of Ministers. Now, to put it mildly, this complex structure could not have functioned in any case. And that was one of the reasons why the March 5 arrangement differed substantially from the dispositions that Stalin had made not so long previously, in November, December, and January of the period. His heirs were not eager to make radical changes because they were concerned about legitimacy, which is reflected best by continuity, and because they were attempting to reduce internecine conflict, if at all possible. But while Stalin had shown his desire to strengthen the party at the expense of the Council of Ministers, as shown by his absence from the latter, his heirs displayed a marked tendency in favor of upgrading the cabinet. In fact, March 5 constituted a beginning rather than an end of the struggle. Between March 6 and March 10, a veritable cult developed in the media around Malenkov's personality. On March 5, it had been announced that he was to be chairman of the Council of Ministers. He was listed first in order of precedence among the new 10-member Communist Party presidium, meaning that he would preside. With regard to the party secretariat, however, the public was told merely which secretaries were added and which were subtracted, but not who remained. This meant that it was left ambiguous who was to be the first or senior party secretary, Stalin's former job. However, initially the Soviet media referred consistently to Malenkov as both chairman of the Council of Ministers and party secretary. And so did foreign communist delegations to Stalin's funeral, including very prominently the Chinese. The cult reached its climax on March 10th when Pravda published a photograph showing Malenkov with Stalin and with the senior surviving member of the International Communist Movement, Mao Zedong. And there are two questions. A, was this done with Malenkov's acquiescence or to compromise him? B, was this only a domestic power device, or were international considerations involved? With regard to the second question, the evidence is not clear. We know from the sign-in sheet that Stalin apparently had bestowed on Malenkov the Far Eastern portfolio. And Malenkov met with a very important Chinese delegation headed by Beijing's number two leader, Liu Shaoqi, on January 5th and 6th in the presence only of the interpreter and a junior diplomat. We know also from the memoirs of Beria's son, Sergei, that for a considerable period, Malenkov and Beria had been deeply involved in Sino-Soviet affairs. 4 years later, when the editor of Pravda, Shapilov, was attacked by Khrushchev for having towed it to Malenkov, he responded, and I quote, "The main problem was our friendship with China, and the closeness of the leadership of the two countries was a symbol." As mentioned earlier, the Chinese delegation had played its part in Malenkov's cult. Conceivably, therefore, the photograph may have served two purposes, international and domestic. With regard to the initiators of Pravda's publication of the picture, the evidence is ambiguous, although it seems very unlikely that it could have been done without at least Malenkov's acquiescence. The problem was exacerbated by the fact that it was not a genuine photograph, but a retouched version of a picture taken 3 years earlier, February 14, 1950, which had included all the other Soviet leaders whose faces now were simply expunged. Consequently, supporters and opponents of Malenkov alike coalesced against him. We now know that he attempted to take the bull by the horns by convening a meeting of the party leadership on the same day and attacking his own cult, including the retouched photograph. And 2 days later, Shapilov, editor of Pravda, received a reprimand. But it was all in vain. The other leaders were not to be appeased, because not unnaturally they felt that what had been done to their images may be done to them personally. On March 14, a plenum of the Central Committee was convened, and we have the protocol. The document contained two versions of the plenum's decisions, including an abbreviated statement that was intended for publication. Malenkov was placed in the unenviable position of having to request his own demotion by claiming that he had asked to be relieved of the party secretaryship in order to concentrate on the premiership. Of course, these two positions had never been viewed as incompatible in Stalin's day. This left Khrushchev in charge of the secretariat. But Malenkov was awarded some consolation prizes. One consisted of the fact that he was to continue chairing the sessions of the party presidium, and the other derived from the confirmation that two of his supporters, Shatalin and Ignatiev, were to remain members of the secretariat. However, the published version did not mention Malenkov's chairmanship of the party presidium. And exploiting this deliberate omission, Khrushchev was to demand that chairmanship for himself only a few months later. Subsequently, Malenkov was to be accused even of having, and I quote, "incorrectly expected to lead the party presidium," a flagrant contradiction of the protocol's explicit confirmation of his chairmanship. The inclusion of two Malenkov supporters in the secretariat was of little help, since Khrushchev's new and uncontested control of that apparatus soon forced the lesser secretaries to submit to his control. Moreover, one of Malenkov's supporters, Ignatiev, was to be ousted from the secretariat within 2 weeks in connection with his role as the interrogator in the infamous doctor's affair. Thus, Malenkov's consolation prizes proved to be as evanescent as snow in July. We have seen how the struggle affected key questions relating to two of the three centers of Soviet power, the composition of the party presidium, successor to the Politburo, and of the party secretariat. There remains the issue of the third institution, namely the Council of Ministers, which appeared to be at least on a par with the party machinery, at least for a brief period. Time and again, Khrushchev and the others claimed that the composition and leadership of the Council of Ministers had been arranged by Malenkov and Beria in tandem and imposed on the others. Be that as it may, if they had such a plan, it had a curiously ragged edges. The cabinet consisted of scores of ministers, although their number was reduced by the new leadership. But a workable executive was required, and that consisted of a presidium numbering about a dozen ministers and an inner cabinet of about half that size. The precedent had been that the Bureau of the Presidium of the Council of Ministers would be composed of members of the Politburo, and it would normally include the chairman, the first deputy chairman — yes, in Russia you can have more than one first — and the deputy chairman of the council. On March 5, this reasonably logical order was thrown into disarray. The Bureau and the Presidium were merged into a single body called the Presidium, and it was to consist only of five members: Malenkov as chairman and four first deputy chairmen, two of whom, Molotov and Bulganin, already had that title, and the two others, Beria and Kaganovich, were raised to this rank. This left other ministers who had been both deputy chairmen and members of the Presidium, as well as having been members of the former Politburo. Although their ministries were enlarged, they were not included in the new Presidium and apparently lost the title of deputy chairman. Now, what is the point of having first deputy chairman if you no longer have deputy chairman? Why have a higher title absent the lower one? Of the four first deputy chairmen, three were given the most important ministries: state security for Beria, foreign affairs for Molotov, and armed forces for Bulganin. The fourth, Kaganovich, was given no portfolio whatsoever, although he had years of experience in construction, transportation, and other important economic tasks that easily could have been cobbled together into a portfolio. However, we now know that the three power ministers were placed under significant constraint. Their demoted predecessors were imposed upon them to be their main deputies, to wit, Kruglov in state security, Vyshinsky in foreign affairs, and Vasilievsky in armed forces. They could be relied upon to resent their demotions and to keep an eye on their new superiors. This was to prove fatal for Beria. When the other leaders conspired against him 3 months later, Kruglov failed to alert him of the danger. The person particularly affected by his exclusion from the Presidium of the Council of Ministers was Mikoyan. At the Central Committee plenum March 14, which ousted Malenkov from the secretariat, Mikoyan was referred to by his previous title as deputy chairman of the Council of Ministers and promoted to be a member of the Council's Presidium. No explanation was given why the March 5 meeting had deprived him of his rank. Other ministers were also mentioned in connection with the enlargement of their ministries. A general statement implied that they were entitled to be deputy chairman. One might think, therefore, that the situation had been rectified. No such luck. An announcement explained that the plenum was being held on March 14 so as to enable the puppet legislature, the Supreme Soviet, to formalize all of the new arrangements on the following date. However, a glance at the official register of the Supreme Soviet shows no such thing. Three of the ministers implicitly promoted were not elevated to their new title until December of that year. And according to the register, poor Mikoyan had to wait until April of the subsequent year. No explanation was ever offered. But there is room for speculation. On March 14, Khrushchev needed his colleague's support to oust Malenkov. Hence, the promises of promotion that were given to Mikoyan and to the lesser luminaries. The problem was, of course, that gratitude responds but rarely to favors already bestowed. Rather, it is a sentiment nurtured by lively anticipation of favors yet to be granted. Consequently, speedy implementation of the offers made on March 14 would have been considered premature if the support of Mikoyan and the others was likely to be needed for the ouster of additional contenders for power. That may be the reason why Pervuchin, Saburov, Mikoyan were not promoted until after Beria's liquidation, late in 1953. Be that as it may, the most important arrangement concerning the Council of Ministers, of course, concerned Malenkov and Beria. It was the latter upon whom the privilege fell of proposing Malenkov to be chairman, a post that, as we've seen, was widely expected to be given to Molotov, who had held that position in the 1930s, whereas Malenkov's work had been almost entirely within the party's secretariat. Malenkov returned the favor by naming Beria first among his deputies. Even more importantly, Beria was to be in charge of the newly rejoined ministries of State Security, MGB, and of the Interior, MVD. Although the other leaders subsequently painted this as a dangerous grab for power on Beria's part, in fact, he had little choice if he wished to remain a player. He had no base within the Communist Party apparatus. Unlike Malenkov and Khrushchev, he had proved singularly unable to pack the post-October presidium with any of his supporters. Thus, he had little choice but to attempt to regain his former control of the state security apparatus, which, as I've mentioned, he lost when he became the head of the Special Committee on Nuclear Affairs. Because of these considerations, it was in Beria's interest to strengthen the state apparatus as a whole, that means the Council of Ministers, and to gain allies who would have interest in sharing this particular predilection. That may have been among the reasons for including Molotov, Bulganin, Kaganovich in the cabinet presidium, even at the risk of alienating the lesser luminaries. The succession crisis terminated temporarily only on April the 3rd, 1953, when Beria and Khrushchev coalesced briefly to remove Malenkov's follower, Ignatiev, from the party secretariat more than a full month after Stalin's initial cerebral hemorrhage. It reached its culmination with the first denunciation of Stalin's cult, apparently at Beria's initiative. A select group of party central committee members was shown transcripts of seemingly bugged exchanges between Stalin and Ryumin, the state security official who had tortured the accused doctors. The display of the transcripts, which featured an apparently demented Stalin, was stopped abruptly after several days. However, even by April the 3rd, the succession had reached no final resolution, since within 12 weeks the coup against Beria took place with its bloody aftermath. Not long thereafter, Khrushchev demanded to chair sessions of the Central Committee Presidium and to be given the title of party first secretary. He tricked Malenkov into co-sponsoring this change. As a reward, by the beginning of 1955, Malenkov was removed from the chairmanship of the Council of Ministers. And by the summer of 1955, Molotov was ousted from the Foreign Ministry, followed in June of 1957 by the aborted coup against Khrushchev initiated by his demoted rivals. Thus, the post-Stalin transition, in the absence of a transfer of power mechanism, consisted of more than 4 years of seismic shocks. In the absence of legitimacy, none of Stalin's heirs could enjoy power unrelieved by constant anxiety.
You've been listening to university professor and director of the Institute for the Study of Conflict, Ideology, and Policy, Yuri Ronin. Professor Ronin's lecture was entitled Stalin's Heirs and was part of a recent one-day conference sponsored by the Institute. Earlier, we also heard the opening remarks for the conference by Boston University President ad interim Dr. Aram Chobanian. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.